Welcome, everyone, to the Better Idea in Healthcare podcast by Care Payment. My name is Laura Aylward. I'm joined by my colleagues, Brian Brown, Vice President of Sales, and Wes Pass, Chief Strategy Officer at Care Payment. Before we get started on this discussion, I want to briefly tell our listeners about Care Payment and our reasoning behind starting these podcasts. Care Payment is a 15-year-old patient financing company that partners with providers to offer their patients zero-interest payment plans for when they need help paying their out-of-pocket medical expenses. We advance cash to the provider based on insights we have on patient payment behavior and take over all the engagement with the patient as they pay off their long-term payment plan. And we realized, because of our history and because of where we sit in healthcare, that we're in a pretty unique position. So we decided to start this podcast to discuss some key themes. The immediate financial impact to providers and patients, the long-term changes to the healthcare consumer and the provider revenue cycle, and how different provider organizations are responding. Today, I asked Brian and Wes to join me to kick off our series, as they both have tremendous experience in patient financing, revenue cycle, financial markets in healthcare, patient engagement, and they work every day with our varied provider customers. We plan to have a series of these discussions, and moving forward, we'll invite some very interesting guests to join us to share their perspectives. So more to come on our future discussions, but for now, welcome, Wes, Brian.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for having us.
So I want to start with mentioning some of the startling stats we are all reading. The American Hospital Association estimates hospitals will lose an average of $50 billion per month through June 30th. The Bureau of Labor Stats just reported that 1.4 million healthcare jobs were lost in April, and that's 7% of the total job losses. And ambulatory jobs actually were the largest part of that 1.4 million, losing about 1 million jobs. Another startling stat, a survey of orthopedic surgeons reports that they expect to get back to normal volume in 6 months, you know, versus in the next couple of months. And there's many factors for that, and we're going to talk about some of those today, but one of them is the hesitation from the healthcare consumer to re-engage with the system. And according to a PwC Health Research Insight report that just came out a couple of days ago, 32% of consumers said they already had or were planning on cutting down healthcare access to try and save money. 78% said they would skip a well visit, a chronic care management maintenance visit, or an elective procedure, a lab test, to cut costs. So again, those are the, you know, three or four stats, but we've been reading every day, and there's tremendous amount of information out there. But those three or four kind of really put structure and thinking around some of the themes we want to talk about today. So I wanted to start with you, Wes and Brian, both, just on what you're hearing out there from your industry contacts and our customers and just everybody in the space related to this kind of crisis we're going through. Brian, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. And first on that PwC Research Insight report, that's just surprising and shocking. I think that's a side of this that many of our hospital clients aren't necessarily thinking about directly, just in the sense that what is the patient mindset of going into this? And that relates to what we're hearing there in kind of the provider settings. You know, we're having conversations daily with providers. And for the longest time, it was this level of uncertainty and making sure that they were doing everything they could to focus on the clinical aspect and kind of the emergency or pandemic response. I think now that things have started to normalize and we're seeing, you know, the curve come down in most places, providers are starting to shift their focus on what the new normal is. And that is causing them to look at how do they engage patients? How do they cut staff? There's a lot of them that are reducing staff, taking pay cuts, because they're realizing that how they used to operate is not going to work in a go forward environment. And that is being driven, from my perspective, in this mindset that providers have to get back to an open state. So they can't continue to not have these elective procedures or these chronic care management procedures. So that's what we're hearing right now, is just how do they get back to that state of openness while maintaining kind of that 30% availability for the resurgence in COVID, if there is one, and what that means and what process and procedures they can put in place to get back to normal, because that is how they're going to survive financially.
Yeah, absolutely. Wes, I know you obviously, I mean, you know, at Care Payment, we work with all different kinds of provider types, but you have a pretty unique perspective. Tell us a little bit about what maybe the non-acute care or non-hospital providers are talking to you about, and even some of your industry contacts from your banking days, healthcare banking and other industry, you know, kind of discussions you're having?
Yeah, absolutely. I think similar to Brian, you know, it's a new frontier that everybody's going to have to prepare for if they haven't already. I'll probably refer to, we're speaking outside of acute care, three good subsectors serve as an example for this discussion: the behavioral, ambulatory sector, and oncology. Just different, but robust and hugely active in the healthcare market. Those sectors and many others have seen a significant impact to volume reduction. These tend to be provider subsectors that are not treating COVID directly, more just restricted in their volume, either due to state laws or due to just patient fear in terms of how they cope with whatever, getting to those providers and working with them. So all of them have been affected with volume. Some have handled a little bit better than others. Behavioral has been very effective at pushing from a regulatory perspective around telepsych and remote kind of engagement with patients, of which they've made a leap forward in doing so. And I think it will permanently change the way they engage in the future. Oncology has been a little bit of a mixed bag of how they approach it. And it really becomes into the level of acuity that that patient is facing. As pancreatic cancer, which is slow growing cancer, they may be better served if they were a higher risk through other mechanisms to sit it out and stay at home and avoid that care. Whereas a higher risk cancer patient, roll the dice and get in there and be seen. So they're learning how to use some of the distance engagement, telepsych, whatnot to react better. Ambulatory surgery or ambulatory sector as a whole has arguably been the one that has had the most finite halt, pause, as it pertains to government and local jurisdictions in terms of just shutting them down and limiting that volume unless it is deemed absolutely necessary, which would could be some, especially some orthopedic events. I think they are also very concerned, as is oncology, about what Brian spoke about and what you said from the PwC survey, all the preventative care, all the preventative screening. You know, has human, we have made so much headway with the patient population to prioritize that. Where is that priority now? All that said, I think ambulatory is probably in the best position to rebound quick, to be the most assertive at preparing for this environment and knowing how to compete. And they will come back pretty hard.
Interesting. I think that, I mean, it maybe in what you guys are saying is these, you know, obviously these big seismic shifts are happening, and those seismic shifts are pretty common across, you know, the acute care and non-acute care sector. But I want to kind of pivot into that kind of changing consumer behavior that both of you mentioned, and Wes, you mentioned it, you know, in kind of the opportunities there. I mean, we're certainly seeing a lot of the concerns and challenges, and I do want you guys to discuss those, but also those opportunities around technology and how digital tools are being, but let's talk about that. You know, Brian and Wes, you know, either of you guys jump in. I mean, what is this changing healthcare consumer behavior, and is it permanent or is it temporary? Or how do you see it kind of coming out, and what are our providers saying about how they're meeting that challenge?
I'll jump in. And just to kind of spin off of what we just said with the PwC piece, preventative care and screenings took a long time to get people to realize that that's important. And in a strange way, that is actually the provider's pipeline for future business. So getting people back motivated as per that PwC, where people are just planning to skip it or not prioritize it, that's going to be difficult. And I believe the providers need to be extremely assertive in terms of making it easy, convenient, and being proactive with these patients to get them scheduled, to get them back in, to get them back reprioritizing their future health, not their current health. And they're going to need to be ready to do that. And in the past, they've kind of waited for patients to come to them, and that mentality needs to change and change quickly.
Yeah, and I'll add a little bit on just kind of what we're seeing in kind of the change in healthcare consumer behavior. I think historically, for the longest time, the physician has been the driver in a patient's utilization of healthcare, and with the shift towards the patient absorbing more of the out-of-pocket expense and the cost, that has minimized that physician impact. So then you take that and you couple that with big changes to the economy, the shutdown of services. It's put the patient in more control, and they're looking at the situation of they have increased financial insecurity with just, you know, 30, 40 million Americans file in front of the stock market is at low levels that we've seen in, you know, a long time, last 12 months. There's been a lot of pressure put onto the patient. So that's going to cause them as the consumer to make decisions that are really driven by their pocketbook versus their healthcare needs, which is, it's going to be unique to see. And I think it's going to have a negative effect overall on the industry. So there's a lot of fear from a patient perspective. There's a lot of uncertainty. So what we're seeing providers needing to do is to realize that it's not a one size fits all solution for the patient. So meeting them where they're at, making sure they have a lot of solutions to drive the patient and engage that patient so that they can keep revenue flowing to the health system so they can sustain themselves.
I agree with Brian on that. I mean, cost is going to be more of an issue now than ever before. And, you know, competition is also going to be higher than ever before. There's going to be less patients. They're going to have less liquidity for the care they need. There's going to be a higher level of anxiety and a lower demand. So these provider businesses, we're already beginning to act more like retail-like entities in their engagement and consumerism of the patient population. They've got to amp that up. And a big part of that is the cost component. And as Brian said, they've got to be creative. They've got to be on theirs, and they've got to have a solution to show the patient, not just wait for them to need it.
Yeah. Brian, I know that you spent some time a couple of weeks ago with, you know, 8 to 10 provider organizations across the country in kind of a, you know, a pretty in-depth discussion. Did you get the sense that these changes that you and Wes just articulated were, you know, they perceive them to be permanent, you know, something that they're really going to have to manage towards, you know, in the long term, or is there even a long term right now? You know, how do you see them as adopting these, you know, moving forward?
Yeah, so getting to have that insight with those providers was very interesting, especially at this time. And more from a, you know, financial perspective of a health system versus clinical, because that's the area that we operate in. What I found interesting was some of them were talking about, you know, they expected June, July to resume back to normal levels, to what they were calling budget levels. And others were saying, we're going to not even be able to run at 70% of budget starting in September. So I think folks are still optimistic as it relates to when they're going to get back to a budget level or a percentage of budget level, but there's so much uncertainty, especially depending on where you're at in the country and what your level kind of at the pandemic is. But I think folks are looking at it day by day. Most organizations are looking at it day by day. Not a lot of them are looking at what the impact's going to be in 2021, which is, you know, you got to have both of those mindsets. How are you going to manage through the immediate downturn? But then what are you going to do to prepare the health system and the organization for 2021 when we have the reset of deductibles? We're still trying to get patients off the sidelines and into health systems. That's going to be huge. So I think some of the more financially stable organizations are looking out that far, whereas some of those that aren't as financially stable, they don't have the foundations or endowments to help them sustain through this downturn. I think they're more looking at immediate, you know, how am I going to live the next 30, 60, 90 days? So it's very different. There's a lot of uncertainty. Folks are all over the place as it relates to what their mindset is in terms of, you know, what the financial outlook is.
Yeah. Wes, you know, some of the words that Brian just used around that kind of those that are looking at that immediate, you know, how are we going to get back up? You and I in discussions, and I know you've had these discussions with some of your provider kind of contacts and our customers. It seems like that's even more pressing, if there is a more pressing right now in that ambulatory, you know, in a non-acute care market. Would you say that's true, or do you feel like they're, you know, financially some of those organizations are relatively stable and able to weather, you know, more of a longer term strategy? What's your viewpoint on that?
Yeah, I think the subsector matters less than the ownership structure. And what I mean by that is, if you have access to the capital markets, that puts you in a different position than if you are physician owned and you've been paying out the retained earnings and form bonuses over the years and kind of go back to zero in terms of cash at December 31st. Also, if you're private equity backed and have a lot of leverage on you and have to deal with those debt partners, that puts you in a very different position. So it's across the board wide. What I would say is, there's a short-term play, there's a medium-term and a long-term play. And the short-term is, hopefully you've access to some debt or equity sources. Second option being a kind of a cost-cutting mechanism, which we've seen in wide range. and not just in the form of laying people off, but turning off new projects, et cetera, delaying those. I believe another great avenue is really tapping into your current accounts receivable. And that tends to be an underutilized mechanism within healthcare, or less successful than commercial business version than healthcare. I think you typically see a lot of providers, depending on the sector, collecting well below 50% of what they're owed. And being able to dig through that population, that source, which is already really owned by the provider, is a huge opportunity. And doing so creatively and friendly so that once things turn back on, those patients come back to them is very important. In terms of a long-term approach, I think you're going to see more physician-backed businesses decide to keep a little bit of a rainy day reserve of cash so that they can survive some of these situations better. I believe a lot of providers will probably push their ownership for a lower leverage profile so that they can survive it as well. But again, the most creative, if you don't have something in place right now, is digging into that accounts receivable in a friendly and effective way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, and we've been talking a lot about that, I know. Let's talk about some of those strategies. I think, as we mentioned, one of the unique places, or we sit at a unique place to really hear about all these varied strategies. Brian, you brought up a great, kind of analogy or around how people are strategizing or focusing. And I read a great quote today about, that providers are required, and particularly even revenue cycle leaders and financial leaders in the hospital are required to, work every day looking through a microscope and a telescope at the same time. So it's that very, very focused, as well as trying to get broader to see what this impact is going to be, even if that's just, the impact for the next 30 to 60, 90 days. So with that, what are some of the strategies that you guys are hearing from your contacts in the industry that people are going to start trying? And then how, as we subsequently have these conversations, we'll be able to look back and say, hey, how successful were those and why? So maybe we can bring some insights continue to bring some insights, even into 2021. But what are some of the strategies that our provider organizations are using today?
Yeah, so one of the biggest ones I'm seeing, and obviously benefits our business, is related to what's in their receivables. So most providers today have payment plans that are on their books that they're kind of self-administering, 5, 10, $20 million in existing payment plans. A lot of providers, those have been sitting there, a lot of providers are looking at those now as a cash lifeline, right? They can convert those, 70, 80, 90 cents on the dollar and get that cash versus a receivable and sustain operation. So that would be kind of the, looking through the microscope, immediate opportunity. At the same time, converting those accounts and having a program in place that gives you cash up front versus putting those as receivables on the books and liquidating them over 36, 48 months, there's a long-term benefit there as well, in the sense that you have a solution that gets the provider the cash up front and that also maintains that patient relationship through, the liquidation or the payoff of that, loan or installment loan or that receivable. What we're seeing also providers do is tap back into that existing population through communication channels to go back to them and say, okay, you've got a payment plan that's active. There's a communication vehicle there because you're paying that bill every month. Let's use that as a way to restart some of the operations within the health system. We know those patients are profitable and they pay their bills and they've got a collection mechanism in place to get the cash up front for their procedures. So let's message to them that, hey, diagnostics and imaging is back open. And don't forget about your provider and when you're looking to get the care that you need. So moving those patients, getting them off the couch, getting them into the organization. That's the biggest thing. The other thing that's been very interesting to see is this shift from providers of wanting to own a process and procedure in-house and getting out of that position. So a lot of times it's billing and statement billing collections or managing those payment plans in-house. A lot of them are saying, wow, we just had to furlough 15, 20 people. We do not want to be in that position again should something happen, a second wave or something happen in 2021. So let's shore ourselves up to be very lean and efficient internally, and then rely on our partners to have to deal with that and staff to those levels and that fluctuation. So we're seeing a big shift and a big interest as it relates to how can you help me with my receivable strategy? Because A, they want cash, but B, they also don't want the long-term liability of having the employees on their books. in the event that there is a downturn again.
So I'll jump in real quick to say I liked a lot about what Brian just said, and it is somewhat self-serving but accurate to say the spot we sit in the market of being able to monetize existing payment plans or accounts receivable on the books is never at a more important point than now, but also building a functional relationship around a friendly engagement in a commercial-like product to do so has ripple effects many years forward. And it just propels that provider into the modern era of payment engagement. I will say that along that same line, something Brian spoke to about reoccurring visits, again, going back to commercial-like businesses, I mean, we've all gotten a million emails from a merchant we used or a store we used that has our email and finds other things we like or re-engages with us so that we continue to use them as our preferred shopping partner. I think providers have to continue to think that way. They have to look at the other 80% of the GDP and say, why are you better with your cash flow recognition than I am? And I believe that's a big part of it. If you've got a paying patient or a patient who has paid, that patient needs to be marketed to and direct marketing, and because you know they do so. And to continue that value proposition of why you are a preferred provider. And then you need to be ready to schedule them at a convenient time and in a convenient way right afterwards, and then just repeat. So pay, market, and schedule, and just keep that cycle going. If they can get in the habit of doing that, I think they will have a much stronger balance sheet in a future state.
So Wes, it's interesting. It's a lot of times organizations struggle with the ROI of investing in marketing. And I think now it's becoming more evident than ever that you need to have a solution that can, where the patient's eyeballs are on it today, and drive that kind of demand marketing back to the organization. And if they don't do that, they're not going to get volume, and other organizations are going to step up and do it. Almost, you know, all the major cities have competitive situations. So what's going to differentiate themselves? And having those tools and marketing engines in place to drive that differentiation is going to be huge, because it's going to be competitive. That's the crazy part is, I don't think anyone realizes how competitive the market's going to get and how there's going to just be a huge demand for that patient spend. And those organizations that are in the best position to attract and market to their patients are going to get those patients and get that spend.
Well, something you just said, I mean, I live in Nashville and I can name a few, and about every major metropolitan area has them as well. But the billboards that show the wait time at the emergency room for one, if not all, of the competing health systems in that market. And I've always been baffled by that marketing approach, because it is wide, it is open, and it's channeling volume to one, the most expensive modality of care, but two, the one that has the highest statistical probability of bad debt creation. Yeah. When at the end of the day, they've got your average large health system has tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or more of experienced patient encounters, of which they know the history of that person, the health history, the financial propensity to pay, et cetera. That is, for some reason, a largely untapped resource to directly engage, directly encourage, and make it as easy as possible to get care, schedule care, and have them pay again. And a more focused mechanism like that would be very impactful.
Yes, yeah, so you guys are, I mean, this is fascinating, because we've talked again about, this very same issues to our provider contacts and industry contacts. How would you guys characterize kind of, or how would you meet the questions back, and how do you meet the questions back when providers say, you know, I'm in, I get it. It's crystallized in terms of I need to be more competitive. But at the same time, these rollout strategies, I mean, Brian and Wes, you both alluded to them earlier. You know, advisory board came out a couple of weeks ago, or somebody from the advisory board, and said, you know, it can be 20 plus weeks before the full rollout happens, and they meet that pent up demand, primarily because of they're so cash strapped. So, you know, then they've had to furlough workers and all of that you described. What kind of process or recommendation do you have for providers of the steps they should take if they say, yes, I know I need to market more. I know I need to bring services and kind of support to my patients. and leverage those that are paying to add on services and to continue to get service and get off the sideline, but I'm cash strapped. So we've talked about a couple of different strategies, you know, cash strategies and the kind of engagement strategies. What recommendation of kind of what do they do first? You know, what would you give to them? Brian, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, don't have any expertise on the clinical side. It's fascinating because I'm hearing about some, you know, rev cycle shops that are furloughing employees because they don't have work, they don't have bills. There's obviously a lot of coding work, but there's not any, you know, patient billing and follow-up just because procedures have been suspended. So they're furloughing them. And I look at that and I go, that's a great opportunity to repurpose that staff and to take that staff that's used to taking inbound calls and talking about a bill and having them do outbound calls to engage that same patient population and talk to them about coming back to the health system in a, you know, just a very high level way versus furloughing them. And those are the people that, you know, are furloughing not because they don't have the cash, just because they don't have the work. So there's some unique strategies out there. You're going to have to fill the funnel of patient demand and differentiate yourselves. And then once you do fill that funnel and you get those patients back in the door, you obviously have to have the right tools and procedures in place to collect and maximize your recovery from those patients. It's going to be more important now than ever to be able to collect in full or close to full from those patients, just so they can keep the doors and open and return to, you know, somewhat of financial stability for the health systems.
You know, Brian took my answer, and I'm very disappointed in that. I completely agree, and we're admittingly oversimplifying, right? But this is a crazy time. This is a unique time to get creative. So I couldn't agree more. You have capacity now within your staff, whether that's electronically or telephonically or however, engage the people who you know could use your care services, who are likely to pay or covered to pay, et cetera, and engage them and get them scheduled now that there seems to be some clarity around timeline. I mean, even if you just decide not to schedule until July, at least start putting things on the books. There's preventative care or any type of other care. Get those scheduled, get them cleaned up, get the paperwork done up front to be as convenient for them as possible, to build a stronger foundational relationship and have a modality in which whatever their obligation is going to be solved on the front end. Don't let cost be a barrier to care for them at the time, at the point of care or afterwards, because right now you have the capacity to figure that out on the front end. So coming up with a good plan in which to do so, to get those exam rooms filled up at the first opportunity, now is a perfect time in which to do so.
And one thing I'd add to that is this is a great time to engage and challenge your vendor partnerships. I know a number of our clients have come to us and asked us about messaging to the patients. And I think it's a great time for others that are listening to this to challenge and seek help from their partners, their vendor partners, because it will really become evident the difference between a partnership and a vendor relationship. You know, we're being asked today to communicate with our patient population, and we love the opportunity to help our partners restart that volume. So I think that's another opportunity for the provider side, is to look within their current relationship structure, you know, people that are plugged into their system, so they can quickly, through statement messaging, through, you know, scheduling apps that they might have partnered with, through Epic, their MyChart platform, how do you communicate? How do you leverage those communication pathways with the patient to drive volume? So I just, you know, as a challenge to the market, as I was listening from the provider side, leverage those relationships, those people that, you know, say they're partners of yours, is this is really now a time to figure out what that truly means. And if they're willing to go to bat and help you guys restart and drive that volume back to the organization.
So in the next couple of minutes or last couple of minutes we've got, talk to me a little bit about, you know, kind of get back wide, you know, look through the telescope versus the microscope. What changes, what fundamental changes or even trends or things you're looking out for as you look kind of, you know, off into the horizon in the next, you know, 3 months, you know, even 6 months or end of year? What do you see as the things that you're watching, our provider organizations are watching, and what could happen? You know, what are the trends you're seeing kind of come to fruition or formulate?
I'll kick it off. I will say, I think you're going to recognize some winners and losers. There's going to be some businesses that obviously struggle, but have a good reputation and good place in the market. And then there's going to be other people that are low levered with a lot of cash on the books. They're going to see this as an M&A opportunity, and they're going to step in and combine some entities to make it bigger and more survivable for the future. If you're a business that does not want to be participate in that and wants to survive, I think you'll take the, you'll muscle through and take this as a good lesson around financial solvency in a down market at a future state, so that you can be better protected than those and not be at risk. But we're definitely going to see some ownership changes. We're going to see some providers that are really struggling. We're going to see some personnel movement. But the ones that have it really buttoned up, I believe, will bounce back and bounce back quickly, because they will be able to grab more market share than ever before.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from my perspective, the biggest thing is, I think we all knew that there was going to be consolidation, especially in the acute care not-for-profit space. We're seeing it in some of the rural providers today. I think this is just, you know, COVID-19 has just been a catalyst to that. We're going to see a number of organizations, you know, shrink or close as it relates to hospitals. So it's kind of accelerated that timeline, unfortunately, because no one was prepared for it. And that means, you know, a lot of lost jobs and a big hit to the economy. But we're already seeing it, the headlines of, you know, staff being cut, executive pay being reduced significantly. There's going to be an accelerated consolidation consolidation of the space. And at the same time, I think the consumer is going to continue to be in more control of their experience, which providers that are going to be successful are going to have to adapt to that.
Yeah, that's right.
I agree with Brian. The consumerism piece is going to take a huge leap forward. I think you're going to see telemedicine, especially in things like behavioral and some other, take a leap forward. Oncology, I think you'll see value-based reimbursement become a bigger priority, so they can actively manage no matter what the environment, and certainly consumerism, of which the ambulatory sector was out in front on. But I also agree, rural health will look very different in a few years, and this was certainly an accelerant for it. So we'll see how that comes together.
Well, great. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you guys kind of kicking off this series with me. You know, we kind of talked about some key themes. Obviously, the drive and putting the consumer kind of in the driver's seat. It's something that has been talked about in healthcare for, you know, forever. And there's certainly been movement towards there. But I agree, and I think many in the industry agree that this is going to accelerate that change. It's interesting because as nervous as consumers are, as particularly healthcare consumers are right now, just with the financial uncertainty and clinical uncertainty, you know, it's going to be important for all of us in the industry to continue to advocate for them and kind of embolden their confidence that they are in control. So we're going to continue on these themes, particularly around the consumerism and really driving financial wellness to the provider. They couldn't need it. You know, there's no better time, no more critical time for that financial stability to return to them. We're going to invite some, as we mentioned earlier, invite some other guests to join us to give their perspectives. So we look forward to bringing that to the listeners and appreciate you and Wes, you and Brian, for all your insights today, and welcome you guys back the next time we convene. So appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Laura. And thank you to our listeners. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.